Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Infrequent Flying Podcast pilot episodes. As always, I am joined by our three intrepid pilots. So without further ado, the man that flies a Spitfire and drives an Aston Martin, Parky, how are you?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you.
And he wears a tracksuit.
Yeah. And he wears a tracksuit too.
At the moment, I don't fly the Spit because we put it away for the winter. I've put the car under a tarpaulin, so I'm more of a DIY man.
Not quite.
And a tracksuit wearing man.
Yeah, it's what your DIY attire should be. It's a beautiful thing. It's an Eastern European look, but I think it works.
It's a little bit disappointing, I'm not going to lie. I always assume, you know, my mental image of pilots is wandering around in flight jackets continuously and silk scarves, regardless of what the actual job is. But, you know, now we know how the sausage is made. It's not quite so impressive. Anyway, so someone else who flies a trainer and used to drive a Shelby Cobra, was it not?
It was a replica, to be fair.
A replica Cobra?
The technical term you're looking for is kit car.
Kit car. It's Duncan.
A cheap one.
It was based on a Granada.
Wow. I mean, that is cool. That really is cool.
This brakes all round, though, rear diff.
That's really pulling back the curtain. You could have got away with Shelby Cobra. Anyway, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm great. Apart from, we're not doing that much flying at the moment, which is a bit disappointing because the old COVID nonsense is still kicking off.
It is nonsense, isn't it? Absolute nonsense. Yeah. I mean, it might not be nonsense to the demographic that we're broadcasting to, but I certainly believe it's nonsense.
In a slightly younger demographic than we are, though, JB.
Yeah, well, quite.
So we're all relatively worried about it. You're like, hey, bring it on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm petrified.
I mean, that does stack up, to be fair.
If Parky even sniffs COVID, he'll be dead as a doornail.
By the way, just so the lawyers don't get involved, we at Pilot Episodes strongly suggest you do not snort COVID under any circumstances, in any form.
Yes.
And lastly, the man that drives a Volvo and flies a desk, it's got us.
Now that's an accurate intro.
Oh, you've heard it now. That is hurtful.
I'm happy with that. That is an accurate description.
Well, yeah, it is accurate.
I'm good, thank you very much. I've been monitoring closely the VMFA 211, the US Marine Corps, flying around on the HMS Queen Elizabeth with 617 Squadron, which has gone very well, thank you. I'll take a little bit of that because that's been my job.
Yeah, that is actually brilliant news. Is there anything else that you can tell us about that without being locked up by military policemen?
Other than so the Marine Corps, they were always due to at this time of year. They came over here, and it was a couple of parts to what they were doing. The first one was just flying over and then getting their stuff on board, and then doing what's called termed CQ. Dunk will know it well, but carrier qualification on a different ship. They'd already done a bunch of simulators and that sort of thing. And then because it's the first time they'd operated off the ship, it was about integrating into it, you know, understanding where they're, you know, mission planning equipment. Clearly they've got their own US systems, that sort of stuff that has been built into the ship. How they were going to just ensuring the F-35s were speaking to each other. You know, there's a lot of mission planning involved to make that sort of happen, that sort of stuff happen, to make sure the beeps and squeaks are all working. And then it was it's like a crawl, walk, run. So once they qualified on the ship, they then started flying together, doing more sort of complex missions. They then got off and did a set of complex missions on what's called CQY, Combined Qualified Weapons Instructor course. So all of our various combat elements run that once a year. And they joined into that, you know, again, which is integrating into the UK air side of things, which they're going to do when they go off on the cruise next year. And then they're off on the way back home in time for Thanksgiving, and then they're back in the new year for some complex further integration and a certification exercise before they sail. So yeah, it all went really, really well.
So how many airmen and ladies and aircraft will they bring to our carrier groups?
So I think,
like, how many do they have now?
I think they brought 10 this time, and it's around about 200 Marines.
Wow. So their 10 aircraft combined with whatever we've got on there, is the main advantage just to see how the ship handles a fuller complement?
Yeah, yeah. You know, so when she sails next year, you know, you've got a pretty impressive combat air power on board, and, you know, right from the get-go, you're demonstrating that integration with a NATO ally. Which, you know, there'll be other NATO allies in the carrier strike group as well, in terms of ships rolling around as well. So, yeah, I think right out the door, it's pretty impressive.
Isn't
I would
it just,
say that, wouldn't I?
Yes, well, I mean, it is your work. All those hours in the Volvo and behind the desk really paying off there.
Well, I think they did.
I think they did as well. Well then. Hey, Doug, have you ever flown off one of the US ships?
No, I haven't.
Not with the... how about working alongside the Marines when they were in the AV-8B?
No, we went... I never actually sailed west over to the States. We always were going east when I was involved. And so we did fly with them, but it was out... God as will know it as well. We went to Yuma to do weapons debts out there. So that's really the only integration that we had flying with their Harriers, and to be honest, it wasn't much integration. It was just, you know, we were operating at the same site, so it wasn't really a you know, two squadrons working together.
Yeah,
we were kind of just using their facilities. But no, we I don't think. No, I'm pretty sure I only operated off Illustrious.
So off the top of my head, when you were flying Harriers, there must have been yourself. As in ourselves, the RAF, and also the Royal Navy, the Marines. Do you ever integrate with either the Spanish? And did the Italians have some Harriers for a little while?
Now I think they did.
I think they did as well, and the Indians did too.
Yeah, they
Indians
did.
Indians had Sea Harriers.
F-35Bs as well.
Yeah.
The Indians had Sea Harriers. Are you sure about that?
Yeah, sure.
Really? Didn't know that. And how much of a jumping capability was the AV-8B? It's so dry and nerdy compared to what we were flying before we moved over to something similar.
Well, it was quite similar, to be honest. I think AV-8B, but the AV-8B, they had different, and I can't remember. You might remember, God, as what they called them, but they had one with a radar and one with the infrared on the front. So it. That they had different aircraft for different missions, so they do air defence, effectively like our Sea Harrier did until we got rid of our Sea Harrier. But the Indians did operate from the Indian Ocean with the Indians, and we did combat against those guys with their Sea Harriers.
Ooh.
And so it was, it was interesting times doing that. It was a really good debt, that, actually.
Nice. I guess we should really talk about some form of training then. Maybe the Harrier is a good place to start with it. With it being such a unique aircraft, where do you actually start to be able to fly it?
So you know, it just comes at the end of of the Air Force training system, really, and it happens slightly differently now. Because, of course, we've got different platforms. So there's similarities and there's differences to when Godders and I, and even Parky, although Parky will probably be able to talk about, you know, piston provosts and, you know, tiger moths and that sort of stuff.
I do remember the Harrier boys was you would just basically pick the most aggressive, arrogant ones, and they'd go. So it was quite an easy selection process, really. You know,
yeah,
the cool mates went Phantom Lightning. It was.
Personality. No, the good mates went Lightning. The lots of good mates went Phantom, didn't they, Parky?
Yes.
To go back to it, just to see if Parky can flash up any more. When we went through training, we started on elementary training, and we do around about 50 or 60 hours on the Chipmunk. Then you'd go to, as long as you pass that course, you'd go to the Takano, and you do about 120 hours on Takano. I think, Goddess, did you do Jet Provost?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that all of us did slightly different training. Well, not slightly. All of us did completely different training, didn't we? I did a flying scholarship and then did a long course on the Jet Provost. You went through EFT on the Chipmunk and then through in the Takano. And Parco, did you do a flying scholarship and then into NJET?
Yeah, I did. Exactly, yeah. So we both got the fly scholarship with the cadets, so got our PPLs, our pilot's license at 17, and actually that's what got me NJET. So we used to pay, and I think we're starting it again, aren't we, Dan? We've got some RAF guys out.
Yeah, we are.
In tech.
Hey, Parky, just explain what NJET is.
Yes, please.
So Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training, and I seem to recall it was about 18 nations back in the 80s when I did it. Obviously, a load of Americans, they had about sort of four or five bases, but the Americans on our course, we had academy grads, so they'd been to Colorado, the academy, but they all wanted to get Shepherd, Texas, which was NJET, because there was a higher percentage of fighters were allocated to NJET, bizarrely, so they were dead keen to be there. And then the Germans, Dutch, loads of, obviously, Euro-NATO, lots of the Europeans, Turks were there. And there was a splattering of all these different instructors as well. So it was a real sort of mismatch. On my course was Americans, four Brits, and then about sort of the first ever Italians. So I think we had about 12 Italians and probably similar number of German Luftwaffe guys. And it was great. You know, it was a year, 13 months, six months on the T-37 Tweet side by side, all like the Jet Provost, but actually a bit smaller, but very similar to a JP. Got 130 hours. So it was a great flying rate because the weather was always pretty sweet. And then after 6 months, you jumped to the T-38, which was quicker than the Hawk, but not as agile, kind of like an F-5, two-seater F-5 with reheat, so supersonic. So that was awesome to be flying that thing. And very much like the Phantom, angle of attack to land it. So it taught you some good stuff for those sort of jets.
The Phantom angle of attack for landing? Is it high?
Exactly,
is it low?
Yeah. It was rather, angle of attack was sort of drummed into you more than airspeed. So when you went back to the Hawk, I remember at Valley, it was odd. You know, there was no angle of attack in the Hawk. You know, you purely flew it, depending on your weight, on the airspeed, which was not really. You'd sort of have an airspeed in the Phantom and the T-38, but you would do the whole thing was really on angle of attack.
There are a few people here listening to this podcast, I would hope, who have no idea what an angle of attack is when you're landing an aircraft. So just help me out here. When you're saying
it's how steep the wing is against the against the relative airflow. You can see, we've probably all seen F-18s doing a slow speed pass where the angle of attack is, I don't know, about 40. You know, the nose is massively up in the air.
Yeah.
But it's flying so slow, it's generating lift like that. Now, you bizarrely couldn't land that slow because you'd smack the nozzles on the ground, and you could do that definitely on Typhoon. You could do that on the F-16. It was 13.6 angle of attack, rings a bell, Goddess, for the landing the...
Now we're getting really dweeby.
Love it.
Yeah.
It's dweeby to start with, but it's getting really dweeby now.
Angle of attack, it's just a very precise way of producing the correct amount of lift. So you've got an instrument, you had in the head-up display in certain aircraft, and you had, on the Phantom, you had an audio as well. So you had a little beep beep and a little, I don't know, I think it was a steady when you absolutely nailed the angle of attack, because
they were built for carriers, so you really wanted to put it down, you know, within a few miles an hour, but the perfect angle of attack on speed. But essentially, the T-38 taught you that, which was good.
But the way it was great. The thing to note with angle of attack is, and the reason why frontline aircraft use angle of attack and training aircraft generally use speed, is because you can have so many different fits on frontline aircraft. So the speed that you land at changes because of all the different the different things hanging off the aeroplane. Okay, it causes different drag and aerodynamics, but the wing always is the same. So if you land at the correct angle of attack of the wing, the speed may well be different, but you're still landing at the correct speed for that fit in that aircraft. Does that make sense?
It does. Yes. Just on the angle,
that is true.
Yes, on the angle of attack, obviously, I say obviously, but when you're at a steeper angle of attack, generally speaking, you're producing more lift. Is that lift from the wings, or are you relying, particularly for carriers, is that lift coming from thrust?
From the wings. So the angle of attack will just continue to increase. It gets to what's called a critical angle of attack, and then at some point when it's so steep, then it can't, most wings, this is not all wings, but we're getting super dweedy now, but most wings will then get to this angle of attack. Once you go past that angle of attack, then the airflow then breaks away from the top of the wing, and it then stops producing lift, and you then stall.
And that's quite serious.
Well, it can be, yeah, certainly. And we've lost, you know, we lose lots of aircraft stalling on finals, which, you know, finals when you're turning into land. We've lost lots and lots of people, sadly, who've not monitored their speed or angle of attack on finals. And the next thing is that you lose control of the aircraft. It generally flicks, and there's very little chance of recovering it.
Ooh,
so it's quite an important lesson during training. And so when we come back to this stalling thing, and I'm sorry if I've interrupted your thread, Parky, but actually stalling throughout training at whatever stage that you're at is always a very, very, very important part of it. And we do it at every stage of training on every aircraft, and we keep a currency, certainly in the smaller aircrafts, in doing stalls and recovering from them.
I just have one more question.
And the big thing, Dunk, on that, bizarrely, when I was out in America, I lost one of the course ahead of me, a top mate, Ed Radford, but he got killed out there, and he stalled in the final turn in a T-38. And, you know, obviously, you know, essentially you think, well, you know, just flying too slow, but so much of it and so many of crashes that have happened during the landing phase, where essentially you have got too slow, but the stall has happened because you're actually pulling as well. And if you're pulling, it's the square root, isn't it, Dunk, of the speed it multiplies by. So you can, you know, whereas an aircraft might stall at, don't know, you know, 100 when it's, you know, just pulling 1G, if you pull 2G, it'll be whatever it is, 115, 3G, even more. And that's the killer. You tend to be, you know, if it's a tightening wind and you're a little bit heavy and you're pulling too much, that is so often the reason for those sort of crashes to occur.
So, hey, just a couple of things there, because suddenly we have gone off down a rabbit hole, and it does, if you're not used to it, it sounds complicated, but flying an angle of attack, or an alpha, as we call it, round finals, don't correct me if I'm wrong, but it's exactly the same technique as flying a speed, right? So it doesn't matter whether you're flying one or t'other. You're doing the same thing to hold a particular, you know, say it's 13.6, as Parky says. You're not looking at it on a dial normally. There's some sort of, you know, instrument that's reasonably easy to use, and it's a combination of sort of nose position and throttle to keep the speed on the way down. You know, for anyone out there who's flown simulators or, you know, how to go in an aeroplane or anything like that. So although it may sound a little more complicated than flying a speed, it's exactly the same.
So I've just got one more question on that then. Do high angle of attack aircraft which come in landing, does that usually correlate with the faster aircraft? So what I mean by that is you would need to use angle of attack to generate more lift in something which is a bit more aggressive, because presumably when they're flying at level, you don't want to be producing that much lift, because lift also makes drag. Does that make any sense whatsoever?
Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, it is the you know, all the jets, the heavy ones, and as Dunk says, the ones where the fit changes. I would, again, this rabbit hole that we've dug ourselves, but God, it's just the example that I meant, though, when you're pulling round the final turn, you could be in your Typhoon at 150 pulling, but the speed could be washing off like a dingbat. Bad example with Typhoon because it won't stall, but another aircraft could stall at that same speed. Whereas if you were pulling hard, the angle of attack would increase, and that would give you your warning, if you see what I mean. So I think in some ways, you know, with those tightening winds and the angle of attack, it would, surely that would give you a bit more warning. What do you think, Doug? Don't know.
Well, the angle of attack would give you more warning.
Yeah, if you were just, you know, when you're pulling through, when that speed is washing off around the final turn.
I don't know. I think, you know, either or. I think it's as Goddard says. And I think we should probably explain what a tightening wind is as well, and a slackening wind. So all of these things. So Parky's talking about a tightening wind. It means if you land in a certain direction on the runway, and we're clearly going to be teaching some people to suck eggs, so sorry about that. But you effectively want to land into wind on the runway. But sometimes, you know, the big fella upstairs doesn't allow us that luxury, and he puts the wind in a different direction. So if when you're turning around the corner, because circuits generally have only one direction, okay, when you're flying around an airfield, you'll, let's say, have a left-hand circuit. So you'll always turn left into the circuit, you'll climb to 1,000 feet, and then you'll do a left-hand turn to land. Now, if when you've got a wind, it's not straight down the runway, if you've got a wind that as you turn finals, it's from behind you, it means turning that corner, you have to turn tighter because the wind is blowing you towards the runway. And what that can mean is, well, so as Parky was explaining earlier, the more angle of bank that you've got on, then the higher the stalling speed is. So it means that you will stall the aircraft sooner. So we are getting a bit technical here, but that's a tightening wind. And you also get a slackening wind where you're turning into wind round finals and you need less angle of bank.
So I have an interesting sort of factoid which ties into this fairly nicely, I might add. So I've been reading quite a lot recently about naval battles in World War II because I'm a nerd. And they had to swap the flagship duties from the battleships to the carriers. Do you know why?
Is that because the carrier was dictating where it had to sail because it had to sail into wind for flying operations?
That's exactly right. So they started with the flagships being the battleships, but then they had to radio over to battleships to change course, and the battleship wasn't really that bothered because they didn't understand carrier operations. So eventually they thought, well, this is useless because we're waiting 40 minutes to change course and we can't get all of our aircraft off, or even retrieve them in some cases. So they switched the flag over to the carrier, and then the carrier dictated the course for that exact reason.
And that's always the thing with carrier operations, in that you know, at some point you're going to be predictable because everyone knows where the wind's coming from, and everyone knows you've got to turn into wind to launch flying operations.
They
do specific things in order to not be predictable, you know, changing the windows of when they're flying and manoeuvring around the place and that sort of thing.
Crikey. So if you're hunting a carrier, the wind's going to give you a good idea which direction it's going.
At some point, yeah. But if you don't know when they're going to go, when the jets or aeroplanes on board are going to go flying, then... you know, you can keep people guessing. Plus, you know, emission controls, as they call it, you know, turning lots of stuff off, so you can't even see where a carrier is, track it, or any of those sorts of things. You know, that's the sort of stuff that they get into.
Wow, there you go. So, when you're training, right, where is the biggest jump in performance? Where does it suddenly become very real? Is it like going from a Texan to a Hawk? Or is it from when you go to the Hawk to your frontline jet? What's the biggest jump?
Well, I think, you know, so if we go back to, I know we sort of branched off because we were talking about the different training streams that we'd all been through. And I was saying that I went to Tucano, and you do a certain amount on Tucano, but there's no, you do a bit of low level navigation, but you're not really doing anything tactical at all. You're just doing aerobatics. And then when you go from whichever stage it is now, Parkey didn't do this, but Godders did. So Godders went from his Jet Provost, I went from my Tucano, and then we went to Hawk. And again, things changed. And initially, and I can't remember if you did this, Godders, but initially we used to go Hawk and you'd do just, you'd convert onto the Hawk on one squadron, and then you'd go to a different squadron to do your tactical flying and weapons training on the Hawk. And then, did you do that, Godders, or were you mirror image?
No, we were the second mirror image course at Bali. So okay. Rather than, you know, the courses before us had done that at Bali and then gone to Chivna and Brody to go and do their weapons training, we stayed on the same squadron.
So just to say what mirror image is, so mirror image, as God has just said, it used to be you do your basic training at Valley, then you go to Chivna or Brody. And what they did is they then swapped that so that both, I think they shut Brody, they kept Chivna down in Devon open, and they kept Valley in Wales open. And now both stations took students right from the beginning. So they did all of the Hawk training and the weapons training on one course, and they mirrored each other. So the mirror was, you know, a mirror course at both Valley and down at Chivna. So it was called Mirror Image, and I did that as well. So the leap up that you're talking about, there's one every time you change aeroplane during flying training, there is a pretty significant step in both performance and the kind of thing that you're doing. So even on advanced flying training, when you're doing your weapons and tactics training, it's actually very basic weapons and tactics stuff. It's not advanced at all in terms of weapons and tactics. And then you go to the operational conversion unit, and even then, when you get to your frontline aeroplane, you're actually just learning the very basics of the weapons systems that it can use and the basics of the tactics. And it's only when you get to the squadron and you then do a combat-ready workup on the squadron, you start getting further into the, you know, the weapons and tactics. But even then, you won't drop all of the weapons that that aircraft can use. And it takes a finite amount of time, even when you're deemed combat ready. You won't have, for instance, in our day gone and dropped a Paveway 3 or a Paveway 2 laser-guided bomb during your combat ready workup. Often you'd have just done dumb bombs and you probably wouldn't have fired an air-to-air missile either. That took a specific weapons camp that you went to. Again, that was based in Valley. We're at Valley in Anglesey.
Well, so you would strap your air-to-air missiles on in Valley. Where would you fire them?
Over the it's over the I was going to say the Bay of Biscay. It's a bit of a long way away. They've got a range at Aberporth is out, you know, the stretch of sea, which I can't remember the name of, just out to the west of West Wales. There they have a big...
Is it not the Irish Sea?
Is it the Irish Sea?
No, probably. Well, I mean, it's between the UK and Ireland. It's a stab in the dark, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess it's not the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, the Welsh don't have a sea, do they?
I think they do. I think it's... Oh, yeah, no, you're right. It's the Irish Sea. It belongs to the Irish. So
So, JB, I was just going to say, you know, when you talk about the big jumps up, it is like learning... You would have gone through learning to drive, you know. Yeah. So the very first time you see that car, before you've got into it, before you know anything, you're a bit daunted by it. But the lessons that you go through teach you, you know, from the very basics right from the beginning through to the end. I remember feeling pretty daunted going straight from a flying scholarship that I'd done when I was 17 to I was 18, I think maybe just turned 19. And all of a sudden I'm into a JP5, a Jet Provost, which could do 350 miles an hour, and you're strapping into an ejection seat the first time, you know. It was all, and you're putting on an oxygen mask and a helmet. So right at the beginning, I think all of those things are the the elements that seem pretty daunting. But then once you get in it, your flying instructor is teaching you it right from the beginning, the very basics of this is how you fly at straight and level, this is how you do turns, this is how you start to climb and descend. So you get so used to it as you go through.
Wow.
I wouldn't say it becomes second nature early on, but you know, you're learning stuff all of the time, and then you get, you know, there's a little bit of apprehension. Am I going to be able to fly the Hawk? What's it going to be like? But then you do so many simulators before you actually get into the thing, and so you're reasonably confident that you're going to be able to at least start them up, and then go off on your first trip. So it happens. It's graduated the whole time, and remember, it does take a long time. These flying training courses take a long while.
I remember when we got the first ab initios onto Typhoon, because we all figured, you know, we'd all, as the boys have said, stepping stone from whatever, you know, jet provost to Carlo onto the Hawk, and then the Hawk to your frontline jet was a bit of a stepping stone, but in performance it was, you know, the Hawk's a bit of a G monster, to be honest, and it went pretty well, but there was a step up into an F4 or Harrier or whatever. But the boys jumping into a Typhoon, we were thinking, well, suddenly, you know, they're into a 9G, real acceleration, certainly in reach, you know, just awe-inspiring performance. But the boys were completely cool with it. It was they duck to water. You know, all the abos we got, I guess we had some, you know, good quality boys, but none of them struggled with the performance of the jet at all. You know, the G suit is particularly good in Typhoon, so that side of it was not a snag. But it was, you know, we thought it would be a real quantum leap, you know, up 9G from the Hawk, but it was pretty cool, and it was quite a big step.
Just out of interest, you were obviously flying with the Dutch. Did you go over to F-16 before you came over to Typhoon?
Yes. So yeah, I sort of did Phantom, Tornado, F-16, then back on the Tornado for the display and stuff, and then Eurofighter. So
the F-16 was really a bit of a trial that the Royal Air Force were doing to see if Parkey could actually, after about 15 years operating as a two crew aircraft, could actually manage on his own.
I was going to say, it does sound like a better platform to move on to the Typhoon rather than going straight from the F3.
Yeah, I mean, the Typhoon wasn't around at the time. The beginning of Eurofighter, where most of the boys were exchange boys, that seemed to be almost all of them were. So they'd flown some sort of multi-role single seat, you know, on exchange, which I think we've explained before. But, you know, you do a three-year exchange tour with another Air Force. You know, boys have flown the F-22, F-18s in Oz, Mirages in France, etc. My one was F-16 in Holland. Goddard did F-16s in the States. And Dunk, unfortunately, wasn't good enough to get one. But there were loads of these to get onto, you know, to the jet. And that's how it started. Then, essentially, it was the dying Tornado force and the Harrier force and the Jaguar force. Those were the sort of the boys that filled the jet. But as Dunk alluded to, the big thing with training was, when you've got to, you know, you've gone through pilot training, you've done the weapons bit, however you've got to, either mirror image or I did Chivana, so you've shot the gun and you've dropped a few, you know, practice bombs on the Hawk. Now's the time you get posted. And it really is, you know, it's the different courses have different ways of doing it, as were eggs, so either hard-boiled or soft-boiled, and you had to headbutt them. And, you know, the one that was soft was was the jet that you got. So, you know, back in the day, I think there were 8 from Phantom, Buccaneer, Harrier, Tornado, Jaguar. There were so many different choices, of which there was the single seat versus two seats. And I think you got a single seat recommendation as well. Because, Dung, I think you were actually posted F3, weren't you? Tornado F3, but that changed to Harrier.
I was, yeah.
Were you a little bit upset when it changed to Harrier, Dunk? Or was it always the dream?
He punched me right in the face.
I was gutted, absolutely gutted. It was a funny old story, actually, because so I got posted to the F3, and at the time there was such a long wait. I waited. I had a great time. I did a year up at Edinburgh flying the Chipmunk as a flying officer, you know, flying the Chipmunk out of Turnhouse Airfield up in Edinburgh, and then I did 6 months flying Hawks out of St Athan, and then I went back to refresh. And when we finished our air defence refresher, they said, "Nope, the jets aren't ready. They're giving them to the Italians, so you're going to have to hold for another year or so." I can't remember what it was, but there was me and one other fella, Matt Elliott, who got a single seat recommend out of the course that we were on. And they said, right, so well, you can either wait or you can go to the Harrier. And I was fed up of waiting. So I
What would the Air Force make you do for a year whilst they're waiting for an aircraft?
Well, it's actually a bit of a bone of contention at the moment, because we now have, in the Air Force, we have such a lot, such a backlog. We have this training system that, you know, is finding it very difficult to cope with the demand that the front line has for pilots. And so we are, you know, the training system is unable to produce what we need at the moment, because it has all sorts of different different pulls from different directions on it, without going into detail on that, which could be a whole different podcast, which we probably need to be very careful where we stepped around. But it means that the guys are now, so the guys where I am, so I'm at elementary training, right at the beginning of flying training for, for the guys. And most of them now, when they when they've arrived at elementary training, have held for 2 years already. So they've been in the Air Force for 2.5 years. They've done their officer training, and then they've gone straight into holding. And they might hold on a squadron, or they might hold in MOD. They could hold anywhere, and they'll get experience of the Air Force whilst doing that. But, of course, they actually just want to be flying aeroplanes.
So these are pilots which have been held for 2 years. And is there anything useful they can do? What are they doing? Mowing the lawn? I mean, surely they need to
No, JB, they are putting them to good use. You know, I mean, it'll depend on the individual, but you know, I bumped into one guy in London who was in one of the defense innovation units.
Yeah.
You know, so as a youngster just finished his degree, he was the perfect individual to be in that innovation unit, going out and you know, looking for new ways that we can do things, stuff that industry are getting on. And actually, you know, Dunk and I both held for around 2 years back in the early 90s.
Well, what did you what did you do for those two years then? Because I guess if you look at your career, it's the other way around, isn't it? Which is,
well,
you have done your
lucky
flying, and then you've done non-flying. So were you doing just non-flying duties for those 2 years?
Well, it depends. So it just depends when it comes. So when we went through, I held a bit longer than that. I held for about three and a half years all in all, a long time. But the bits that I held, I was for between basic flying training when I didn't have wings, and going to Chivna to do my advanced flying training. I held up at Lucas, and I held in an air show office, and it wasn't great, you know, to be fair. It was, you know, it's still, you know, trying to sort out the air show. So it was interesting to do with that. But of course, everyone that is on flying training wants to just be doing flying training.
Yeah,
but then my second hold came, which was the longest one, which was nearly 2 years, came after I'd got my wings, which meant that I could go and fly. So even though I was holding, I was still flying. It just, I wasn't doing productive flying. So you can't just...
I do feel, Dunk, for the, you know, for yourselves, to be honest, and the, especially the youngsters, because as you just said, you know, you're just chomping at the bit to get your stickies on, you know, something vaguely fast, and, you know, it's what you've joined and what you're training for. And it must have been, you know, again, I was not that much further ahead of you, but, you know, that sort of 5 years or whatever it was. But I guess when the JP was going, and we had, you know, Valley, then we had Brody and Chivna with attack weapons units, there were no holds. We never, it was just something, you maybe, you know, had a month or so, but, you know, pilot training took 2 years. That was the deal. And, you know, you just cracked through it, and all of us were, you know, 21 on fighters. And I do feel for the youngsters now, you know, the youngsters pitching up at on the Typhoon were sort of 28 years old, and they joined as quick as they could and done pilot training as quick as they could. And it is a shame, but I guess it's the way it is at the moment. And, you know, the COVID's not helping, as you say, Dunk, with training and, you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
In the new aircraft that we've got, but it's one of those things, once you've got a hold, it's very difficult to get your, you know, get that backlog sorted, because you know, obviously, unless you just stop the intake for quite a while, which they actually did.
So ours was a combination parky of the first Gulf War, which started when Duncan and I was at Cranwell. So because of that, all of the operational conversion units had closed. They'd essentially stopped because they were using all of you guys, you know, the experienced guys, because there was such a draw to get fighters, from a fighter perspective, fighters out to the Middle East. And then, exactly as you've said, you've then got a backlog. Also, at the same time, you mentioned the fact that there were eight different types of aircraft when you were going through. But remember, then, you know, we lost the Lightning, then the F4 went, then the Buccaneer went. And we started drawing down in that post sort of 91 as the Cold War came to an end, post 1990, you know, it's almost sort of peace dividend, that we started drawing down the front line. Therefore, and unfortunately, the demand in any training, let alone flying training, I think is always going to be cyclical like that. As you draw down forces, you get to a steady state, and then you start to increase forces again, and the tap has to go on. You have to turn the tap on in terms of recruiting and getting people through there. And it is always going to be behind. And, you know, in recent years, we've drawn down the as Duncan mentioned, you know, from Jaguar, Harrier, Tornado F3, Tornado GR4. So, as you know, you've still got a bunch of... a load of pilots, air crew around there, who then transitioned across to other aircraft, whether it's Predator or Reaper these days, any of the ISR platforms, into Lightning and Typhoon, which meant that the tap turned down. As also the same time that we've completely transitioned the flying training system to different aeroplanes, and, you know, are working through the different ways of doing it. So, you know, it's just it's a set of circumstances, and it's unfortunate for the guys who are champing up and joined to be pilots. But as you know, as I mentioned there, depending, and I think they are more and more getting jobs that will serve them well for later on in the future. So where we were 19, 20, 21 thrashing around, we still had an awful lot to learn about the Air Force. So if you take my career progression, at some point I had to do a ground tour. I know you guys haven't, and I've done more and more of them. But you do that, and you get a much broader understanding of the Air Force. So whilst they are not 20 years old on an aeroplane, and by the way, this is the same across almost every other Air Force in the world right now, because tons of people are transitioning their flying training systems. Tons of guys, you know, they've almost all people have drawn down. I was talking to a US guy the other day who was head of the pilot, what was it called? The pilot recruitment task force or something like that, looking at a big hole that they had in recruiting and not being able to get guys through flying training. So there's a bunch of different factors, but I think as long as we use the guys properly before they hit flying training, then you are cutting out a bit of the career that they'll have to do later on as well.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of valid points there. I'm not entirely sure that everyone would sign up to not fly, but it is one of those things, and I'm sure that you boys will have a tremendous disagreement on this, you know, more roundly, would you not say?
Yeah, so I'm not saying in any way, shape or form that, you know, it's all right not to go flying when you joined up to do that. But it is what it is right now. And I know there's a lot of people working hard to try and make it, you know, quicker from joining to getting onto the front line, because we need the pilots on the front line.
Can I just ask a quick question? From the time that you guys started training to now, has the say if everything went perfectly to plan, has the amount of time that you spend training decreased because of technological advances, simulators, that kind of thing?
Yeah, flying hours have definitely decreased. You know, we would, I'm not sure what the J. Peter Carner, but I'm hazarding a guess you'd get a couple of hundred hours, probably maybe 150 before you're into a Hawk. So, you know, you'd come out of pilot training with 250, 300 hours. And you know, absolutely, there's, you know, simulators, if they're great, you can do so much work in that of the systems. You know, a lot of it you still do have to fly, but there is less flying hours and more simulator stuff these days than it was. And, you know, some of the trips back in the day were just, you know, it was just not hours building, but gaining experience. You know, it was great fun doing solo formations and solo navexes, and you were maybe just sort of, you know, cementing in stuff that you've learned. But, you know, there was probably some flex that you could chop, and they clearly have. But it was, you know, pilot training was and always will be great fun. You know, it's a mountain you have to climb. It's various skill sets that start off pretty difficult. Some you find easier than others. Nobody has an easy ride through pilot training, I would say, other than Dunk. But it's you know, it's the way it is.
There was no easy ride on my part, let me tell you. Hey, I think the difficulties you bring up, and it's probably again worth talking about, you know, given that we're talking about training, is that we call it synthetic training. And we can do an awful lot with it. The simulators that we have that now have replaced those flying hours they're very good, there's no doubt about it, but they cannot replace, and it doesn't matter what stage of training you're at, I think they cannot replace real world flying, because there's two elements to it. It's very difficult to put the number of inputs that you get from external sources, even if you're just doing a training sortie. I went out to do one the other day. We have we call it a flying training device. It's not a simulator, but we do a sortie on the ground, and then we go and do it again in the air. And the students find it so much more difficult in the air because, of course, air traffic are talking to them. The weather is constantly changing and is different. You know, you can't just put one weather scenario that you would put in the sim. You can't do that in the real world. And it is exponentially, perhaps exponentially is too much, but it's certainly far more complicated in the real world, even in an elementary trainer. And when you put that forward to F-35 and things like that, even then, even though you can practice that interoperability between those platforms, and it is a fantastic simulator, it still can't simulate some of the inputs that you'll get when you're out there, and it also can't simulate the fear factor of landing on a carrier with a 200-foot cloud base, because you know that you're in a simulator. Whereas actually when you're doing it for real and the carrier's, you know, bucking up and down and the weather's pretty crap, and the human instinct is then to, you know, elevated heartbeat, and that fear factor comes into it. Perhaps fear is not the word, but certainly you're a heightened state of arousal, which you may not be in a simulator.
Yeah, talking of simulators.
I was just talking to it was a guy who used to fly the S3 Viking just the other day, and he was talking about the they were on a it was exercise rather than operation, but they were sort of semi blue water ops. They didn't want to divert the aeroplanes.
What are blue water ops, Goddess? Just tell us.
So there's no land diverts. So you're only landing on the ship. You haven't got anywhere else to go. So you're all the way down to minimums. So there were three. He said there were three F-18s, and the weather was starting to come in, so they needed more gas. So they launched three S-3s to go and refuel these guys. Then this particular guy, so they refueled these guys. They hooked up, had a S-3 each to go and tank off, had enough gas to then go back round through an instrument pattern as the weather started coming in. And he was the last one to land. It had transitioned to night, and it was a 200-foot cloud base with half a mile visibility. And he said, as he rolled into this thing, he and obviously there's a co-pilot in this as well, and he had a quite high hour co in there, who they both kind of looked at each other and went, right, here we go. And S3 being an old aeroplane, you fly the ILS equivalent down, and normally you transition to a visual approach when you hear that phrase, call the ball, Roger ball. That means they've now transitioned to visual and they're going down. But when the weather's bad, the LSO can take over and give them a few more.
That's the landing safety officer.
Yeah, landing safety officer can give them a few more. He said you never land at night with your landing light on, but they got him to turn the landing light on so they can try and see his aeroplane. The LSO could see the aeroplane through the mist and cloud and everything. And he got to a point where LSO, I can't remember what the phrase was there, but paddles had him. So LSO is giving him come left, power, come left. And simple things like, I guess as an LSO, you're looking at this thing in the opposite direction. He's telling him to come left. He knows because he's going to crack his wings to turn left, he's going to drop a little bit. So he's asking him to put the power up at that particular point. And they're saying, right, call the ball, and he's just not seeing it. And at some point, the guy in the right seat goes, I've got it. So he calls Roger ball, looks up and transitions to this visual approach, and he's off slightly. So, and this is less than half a mile to the ship, about 150 feet, is then having to just maneuver this thing and slammed it onto the deck. I said, what wire did you take? He went, I don't care, I got one. And he said he was still shaking about 12 hours later. So Dunk is 100% correct. If you came out of a simulator like that, you would not have the visceral physical reaction that this fella did, trying to put a Viking down on a carrier in a cold, wet, dark night with nowhere else to go. You're going to run out of fuel and eject.
Just to be clear, S3 Viking, that is the anti-submarine warfare.
It was, yes.
Right. Well, in that case, he was refueling. Yeah, he was in the refueling. He was refueling his mates.
Yes. Right. So they'd. I don't know whether they converted them to it or whether they could do it as well. But the Vikings could refuel other aeroplanes.
Yeah, I'd hate to correct you on the podcast, but if that was the case, he wasn't flying an S3 Viking. He's flying a KS3 Viking. But I wouldn't like to mention that actually.
No, I'm here to be corrected. I don't deem to know everything, but let's call it a Viking.
Yeah, and if he was transporting stores, that would be a US 3 Viking. But again, I don't like to talk about those things. But yeah, I mean, it just shows difference. It just shows difference between real world ops and simulators.
No, exactly. And I mean, as Dunk says, I don't know. You'd have to ask one of the young pilots going through at the moment, but the there are, we used to have a do you remember, Parky, it was a cardboard, I don't know whether you did on the T-37, but a cardboard cockpit. So yeah. In order to learn your checks, they'd give you a facsimile, a cockpit of I mean, pretty much actual size most of the time.
Yeah.
That you would then build on your desk in your room. Put your chair underneath it, and you would run through the checklist, and your hands would go to the various switches around the place. You got used to the cockpit.
Do you want to
wear his flying helmet at the same time?
Yeah, he did. But nowadays, the guys get given computerized training. Certainly, when I was doing a bit of tutor flying up at Wittering, there was a ton of the guys either going through the elementary flying training or on the tutor or the university air squadron were sat at this little cockpit thing. There was three or four of them in the crew room there with actual switches and things on, you know, using that. And then there was another computer base station that someone was using and doing actual flying on it as well, whereas we didn't have that back in the day. So there are
some things,
clearly, as you would expect, that are massively helpful and probably put the student above where we were when we get in an aeroplane for the first time.
So
you know what, though, I think there's some things. So we've gone from that we don't have cardboard cockpits anymore. They have what do they call them? DDRs or something. But anyway, whatever they call them, they're a computerized checks trainer. But it means that you know when you on a flight simulator or something, you have to scroll round with a mouse to look around. You can't look at the whole cockpit, and so you have to scroll round and then with the mouse press a button to make that switch go on, so switch your fuel pump on or whatever it is. But I just don't think it's been thought through. A cardboard cockpit is so much more, it's so much easier because you learn the pattern of the flow of the checks. And even though you're not turning it on, it just doesn't flow properly with one of these computers that they're learning their checks on. It might be that it's just me and I'm just old school, and perhaps the kids are absolutely fine with it. But it just, I think sometimes we've tried to make things too complicated in training, and it's not always, doesn't always bring out the best result.
It's probably worth saying as well, Dunk, though, in our day, for example, when you went Harrier, there was a two-seater, there'd be some QFI in the back flying instructor who would, essentially send you solo on the thing. You do a couple of trips and then off you go. I remember the Buccaneer was, I think, the only jet of my period where, although it was two-seat, there were no two-seaters. There was no controls in the back. So the boys used to do some stuff on the Hunter, I think, up at Lossie. Then they jump in with some experienced nav and off they go sort of solo in the Buccaneer. Whereas now, with F-35 and also Typhoon, they just jump in it. The first trip they fly airborne, they're on their own. And that, that's good that they've been doing that now for, a few years and absolutely no snags. And the sims are good, that they are well prepared and, they just jump into the jet on their own for the first time, which is cool.
That is cool. It also sounds terrifying. Hey, can I just go back to Goddard's, your story about the S3 Viking? Very quickly.
The KS3.
The KS3 Viking, thank you. It could have been a US.
Another variant.
the UKS3.
So Winkle Brown flew off the Eagle, didn't it? Was it the Eagle that he flew off to supply Crete, Malta?
No, I think that was Jeff Wellham.
Jeffrey Wellham,
yes, of course. No, Winkle Brown was the naval aviator, but it was Wellham that flew off the carrier.
Yes.
You're right. And then I think it was the Eagle that was later sunk.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So I found this out, which I found astounding. So that S3 landing, or KS3 landing, sounded pretty terrifying. Listen to this for unbelievable. When they first converted the Eagle, so the Eagle was meant to be a battle cruiser, and then they converted it into an aircraft carrier, one of the early ones, so they didn't really know what they were doing. They built the Eagle with twin islands, so you'd have to land in between two islands. But then to connect the islands, so it'd be easy to get to and fro, they then connected the islands with a bridge. So if you were landing, you'd have to land between two islands and underneath the bridge.
No.
Yeah. Isn't that insane?
Was they have a picture of it? Are you sure they were? Is there a picture of it, JB?
Well, I guess back in the day, these things were so slow. But, still, you don't want to be landing between two islands and underneath a bridge. I'll try and find it for you.
Hey, back to the training front, Dunk. As someone who's in the middle of all of this, we didn't get a lot into our individual journeys, but I think we done it before, you know, in terms of chippies and T-37s, JPs. Do you think, so with the Prefect that the guys are going to now, is that a better training aeroplane for guys to then go on to the Texan and the Hawk if they are going in that particular direction? Because obviously we're talking fast jet. Clearly you can end up on helicopters or larger aircraft or ISR aircraft as well. Is it a good bit of kit?
I think it's great. I mean, I do. I was really quite dubious to start with, and perhaps I've still got reservations in terms of, right, this is an elementary trainer. So it's about learning the very basics of flying and learning to fly attitudes rather than, you know, looking at the instruments and learning to look out in the right way and just cement the foundations of flying, for which you don't need a high performance aeroplane. You just want it to be very basic. And I think the guys, they cope with it. It's interesting what Parky said about the guys going to Typhoon and then coping with that performance. I think there is quite a lot of their capacity is taken up with then having to contend with the performance of the first
Excuse
plane.
Me.
And you're right, JP.
I'm okay.
And,
he's been sniffing COVID.
Yeah. And but they definitely cope with it. And I think, to answer your question, I think it must prepare them far better. The fact that it will, you know, cruise at 180 knots and they're only going to leap up 60 knots to be cruising at 240 on Texan. And they're going to have so much more to help them on Texan, like head-up display, etc. And indeed, now we've got a training system in place where we've had two guys go through, which is going Prefect direct to Hawk and not doing the Texan, because the performance of the airplane is such that it's deemed that you can do that. Now, it doesn't have a head-up display and, you know, it is limited to a certain extent as to what you can do with it. But the proof in the pudding will be as to whether those guys, how they perform on Hawk T2, having gone straight from the Prefect. But it is a really, really good aeroplane.
Do you think they're ahead of the curve in operating an aeroplane? Because, you know, flying an aeroplane is flying an aeroplane. You can either do it or you can't. And you know, speaking to air traffic is the same, dealing with weather, all of that sort of stuff. But clearly there's a reasonable amount of kit in there. It's a modern aeroplane, which is what they're going to see in the T2, is what they're going to see in a Typhoon and the Lightning. Does that put them ahead of the curve compared to where we were getting out of the Jet Provost and going into a steam-driven Hawk?
Yeah, I think so, because they have got to manipulate that kit inside whilst making sure that they're not seduced too much by all of that magenta writing that's down there. All of those, we've got four multifunction displays in the Prefect, and so there's a lot of information presented to them, and it is about learning what you need to concentrate on and when, and if you should be using certain parts of the kit and when you should be using it. And so I think it probably does got us. I think it does give them an advantage over what we had with an artificial horizon and an airspeed indicator and not much more. So, yeah, I think, it's definitely a step forward. But sadly, there's a step backwards as well, in that, you know, the aeroplane's procured, and you may have heard this, but it doesn't have an engine protection system on it. So the guys have got to be very careful. I mean, it's good in one way, but they have to be very careful not to over-torque or over-temp the engine, because you can do it very easily in this aeroplane. And although that's a good thing to learn in terms of they're learning a skill where they are looking after the aeroplane and they have an empathy with the aeroplane in terms of how they're handling it, certainly in the with the power lever. But they're always going to go on now to an aeroplane that has carefree throttle handling. So again, they're taking a proportion of their capacity in learning this particular technique that it's got on Prefect that they'll never use again. So there's swings and roundabouts.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, how does it work down for the helicopter boys? I'm just trying to think, is it, you know, they're always going to cut their teeth, and so much of helicopter flying, it's obviously so different, the skill set,
yeah,
that we're doing that at Shawbury, that know, they're finding something quite advanced with gear. I mean, I mention it because my lad is just about to start Army Air Corps, and he can't wait, but he says it's going to be the fastest thing he'll ever fly, you know, by some margin, because it's quite advanced. But then he'll go to the helicopter, you know, and have to, or not relearn, but, you know, some of the stuff maybe is quite advanced, but stuff he won't ever have to use.
And I think what they've done with Parky is they've noticed that, and they've... so I think after James's course, the Army will just go straight to Shorebury. They won't do the effect. And the Navy, of course, I'm not quite sure exactly how they're going to do it, how they're going to... Because, of course, the Navy have got both rotary and fixed-wing flyers. So at the moment, the training system works differently to how when we went through. That at the end of their elementary flying training, 24 hours of flying is all they get, and then they get streamed as to whether they're going to go fast jet or multi-engine or helicopters. So it's a very, very short period of time in which to be able to tell if someone is of the correct standard to go to each particular platform. Yeah.
But I guess, Doug, if it works with the Army boys, for example, and they go straight to Shorebury, crack on, they're fine. You could argue, just to save a bit of time and less hold, you could go, look, any of you boys, you know, maybe done a bit of flying before, you've got good reports, and you want to go helicopter, you could almost just crack straight on, go straight to Shorebury, conceivably. I guess that would, you know, you wouldn't get streamed, as you say, fast jet, multi-engine or helicopter, but it might be another way of just, you know, shaving off a few hours and courses for people.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I've had that exact same thought process in how they do that. One of my students recently had 300 hours. He had 300 hours flying gliders, some powered aircraft, motor gliders. And although he was, you know, learning stuff at elementary flying training, the fact is he could definitely fly an aeroplane. He was fine. And okay, there was just a little bit of tweaks in, you know, what he needed to do. But I thought, you know, exactly as you said, God, as well, this guy should never be at elementary flying training. He's far too good. It's effectively, he should go straight to basic training.
Yeah.
But the thing is he came there going, well, I don't know whether I want to go fast jets or I want to go helicopters. And luckily, I've spoken to him, and he's seen the light at the end of the tunnel, and he wants to go fast jets. But the fact is because that process isn't there that was there when we were around, when we were going through training, and God, as you went straight from your flying scholarship with a, you know, perhaps not quite that many hours, but a number of hours, and you, Parky, as well, and went straight to your basic training. And indeed, you know, that it used to be when we joined that you did fast jet or nothing. That was it. You joined as a fast jet pilot, didn't you? And then you didn't go, I'd quite like to go helicopters. That's not how it worked.
Just on that, when you're making your decisions, and this is a personal question, really, as to how you thought about things going forward. Did you just want to fly the most capable machine, or were you more interested in doing the most amount of active work? So I imagine, you know, if you were flying ground attack, or definitely if you're flying helicopter, you're more likely to see more interesting missions or actual live action than you are if you're flying a fast jet, because you're unlikely to come up against fast jets there. But on the other hand, if you are flying fast jets, they are more fun to fly, I guess.
It's an interesting question, that. I mean, I think from my recollection going out, attack weapons, or it was mirror image for the other boys, but you've basically done... I think the course was quite geared towards low level, and it was great fun flying at low level in a Hawk, you know, trying to find a target and doing that side of it, maybe getting bounced and low level evasion. You did a bit of air to air, but it, because there was no radar in the Hawk, a bit of air combat, it wasn't that advanced. It struck me, and I remember leaving, or, you know, at the end of TAC Weapons before I got posted, I felt more geared towards ground attack, and that's actually where I wanted to go. And, you know, I kept getting lost at low level, and I was low average 2.6, so they went, mate, you're going Phantom. And it was brilliant. It was the best thing, you know. The Air Force is quite wise in some ways. We were chatting about how they to another mate, how people got posted, and most seemed to suit actually the aircraft. Maybe we would have all fitted in no matter what we got, but I was absolutely a duck to water with the Phantom. It was fantastic and I loved it, this sort of the air defense bit. Multi-role was great as well, but I think when I was early, I loved it on the F-16 when we went to Goose. I would tend to try and choose to do the bombing Starfighter, cardboard cutout tank. It was just great fun. But the stuff that we like to do most probably on the F-16 was the air-to-air. It was just more fun, more dynamic. The gun sight was brilliant. Maybe do a little bit of bombing as well. But most aspects of fast jet flying are brilliant. But so to answer your question, when I came out of attack weapons, I was actually more thinking I would prefer to go more ground attack, and I didn't. I guess, Dunk, when you went F3, I mean, genuinely, you weren't that upset, were you? And you obviously went Harry, and you loved it as well. So, it is what it is.
I think, it's horses for courses, isn't it? Actually, I did particularly well because I wanted to go Jaguar. And I wanted to go single seat, ground attack, as Parky's just spoken about. But also, the certain forces had certain reputations. And it's interesting what Parky just says about they send the right people to the right place in the end. But anyway, Jaguar, they were based just north of Norwich.
Very chilled, nice bunch of people. I don't think that would have suited.
I wouldn't have fitted in, would I?
I think that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because I wanted to go Harrier. I genuinely can't remember at what point I wanted to go Harrier. But I know that flying with Sean Perrott, my primary instructor at Valley, had an awful lot to do with it as well, kind of cemented it.
Yeah.
So I bet you probably had a Jaguar instructor somewhere along the way, and Parky, you may have had a... And I think that's an awful lot to do with it, isn't it, chatting with the guys in the crew room? I know the way the helicopter guys have just done an outstanding job for the last 20 years now in Afghanistan and Iraq, that an awful lot of people, and it got a lot of publicity over the last few years, that there's quite a lot of people joined that want to go helicopters in the end, isn't there, which is completely different from when we started.
Well, I think the other thing is that they look at the fast jets of today, and when we were going through they were pretty steam driven. They were complex in their own ways, but they weren't fly-by-wire. They were just still stick-and-rudder aeroplanes that we were going to. And now you look at F-35 and Typhoon, and the guys think, well, I won't really be flying those as such. It'd be more of an operation. And therefore, that this is their mindset. I try and put them right. God has just raised his eyes. They're thinking, well, I won't be doing as much actual flying and combat and fighting, interesting, exciting stuff that Parky was talking about in the low-level environment. But if I go helicopters, then I will. I'll still be flying most of the time, actually stick and rudder flying at low level, and it'll be... So that has changed people's mindset to a certain extent. The youngsters now coming through, there's quite a few, actually, that want to go helicopters. Although I just looked after
a course. You'll definitely see that. Even it was just when you were ditting on and we were talking about Shawbury, I suddenly remembered, obviously, that you boys, when you went Harrier, you did 10 hours or whatever you did at Shawbury learning to hover. And I always remember thinking, that must have been a hoot. What a brilliant course. Just, you didn't go solo in it, but you just gooned around in a helicopter for a couple of weeks.
It was the best,
greatest course I've ever done.
It was fantastic. Yeah. It was only 6 hours. But you didn't have to learn any checks. They were started and shut down for you. You just had to do the flying bit in the middle. And you did, confined area hovering as well. So hovering into trees on all sides and hovering down into a small space.
You two boys must be, I sort of have a secret hankering to go. I'd love to have a go, on the Reds, we got the odd go. They gave us the controls and, I was vaguely cool to, something like the hover where you had to, and then everything seemed to be connected in a random way. But you boys, did it not sort of, do you not at times think, I wouldn't mind going helicopter after that experience? Because it's kind of a cool thing to do. It is, you know, real flying. You know, you are flying that thing to the last inch onto the ground, as you say, in some pretty tricky conditions. Yeah. And, you know, I always think, you know, when you're on flight safety courses and, you know, we get on about, oh, I've got this story or that, the helicopter boys are the best ones. They are just unbelievable, the stuff they get up to.
Yeah. If I hadn't gone the way that I'd gone, I always maintain that what I'd love to have done was search and rescue helicopter flying. I think that must have been just fantastic.
And pretty rewarding too.
Yeah, yeah.
I imagine.
And terrifying. And
there's a good point there, JB, about the rewarding aspects of knowing exactly why you're going to work on a daily basis and, you know, saving someone's life, you know, whether you're doing it daily or otherwise. Yeah, you know, I can see that. But and look at your lad, Parky. You know, if he gets to get an Apache, that must be a good crack.
I'll be awesome. Absolutely. I mean, he clearly can't wait. But the problem Dunk would have with search and rescue is after you picked the survivor off the mountain, you'd punch him in the face for getting lost.
No. Parky, they jump out within 5 minutes of being in with Dunk. Put me back in the sea. Put me in the sea. I'm going to take me chances.
In fact, don't give me the dinghy this time. I'd rather just swim.
Hey, yeah, so, we've probably been rambling on for a bit, haven't we?
Yeah, an hour and a quarter, boys. Brilliant stuff.
Yeah, we better wrap it up. We have got one question. Well, we've got a couple of questions. I know we haven't got a lot of time.
Well,
do you want to crack one of those or wait for next time?
Maybe wait for next time. I had one more question, which I think I'm going to ask.
All right, we'll do questions next time.
Yeah, I'm going to ask one further question because I think it's quite an interesting way to finish it. The Hawk trainer. You all used it, right? And you all used it when you were fairly green. Dunk and Parky, did you have a new appreciation of it when you returned to it from the Reds? And could you do much more with it than you originally could after you were experienced pilots?
I mean, yeah, I remember. A first trip in the Hawk, and you know, I'd flown the T-38, which just seemed more modern, and it had reheat. And I jumped into this quirky little Hawk, and I remember the throttle seemed to be like a scaffold pole with one button on the top, and the stick was a bit weird, and there was no aileron trim on the stick, so it was just, it seemed very quirky and archaic in terms of the gauges and bits of the Hawk. And, you know, I remember going to the Phantom, you know, probably 9 months later, and thinking, oh, there we go, thank God for that sort of thing. And then when I got the Reds, I had to sort of mix it in. I remember sort of every time you brake in the Hawk, it could be quite snatchy, the brakes, and be a bit sort of lefty right on the runway, thinking, oh, God, the Hawk. And I genuinely rate the Hawk as one of my favourite aircraft I've ever flown now. It is just the most fantastic machine, and I think it's a quantum leap over a T-38 in terms of how it turns and handles, and it's just, it was reliable. It was just a brilliant bit of machinery that you could fly at 400 knots, you know, 450 miles an hour, and it would hardly use any fuel, and it was just brilliant. An absolutely perfectly wonderful bit of machine to fly, and you know, flying it with the Reds, nine of you looping and rolling together with this thing, it's just great. Fantastic aircraft.
I completely.
Well, I don't know if you.
I mean, it's going back to it. It's, and now, of course, there's T2 and T1, and having then, I've flown both T2 and T1, and I learned to fly T2 in 2016, I think it was, and so started flying on it, and then I had the requirement to go and fly T1 again at Leeming with 100 Squadron. And so we flew Hawks actually all over the world. So different, I think we went to, so Oman had Hawks, so we went and flew Hawks with them. So different types of Hawks. But the T2 and the other different types just actually aren't a patch on the T1. The T1, the initial Hawk that we flew through training and that we flew on the Reds, was just the sports car of all Hawks. It's lighter, it, you know, it didn't have any of the kit in it. It was very much just hands and feet, and that was it. And it was the most fantastic aeroplane. And I think to answer your question, the answer is yes, you could do more with it, but only because you had more hours under your belt when you went back to it. You had the confidence to operate it a little bit further outside of the envelope that you'd been operating it on, sort of when you were going through advanced training. You just had a bit more knowledge and a bit more confidence with it.
Awesome. I think that is a good place to leave it then. God, is it? Are you still on Twitter, mate?
I'm still there at Goddess Twit. I've been a bit quiet recently, but I should be back on there reasonably soon.
Excellent. Got Lego. We've got Lego Parky, of course. I don't know if I've heard of Lego Parky for bloody months now. And
that's because we haven't been around for months.
That is true. It's almost like you've been busy, Goddess, almost. And Dunk, where can we find you?
Well, I'm at my Twitter is at Doug Major, but I don't often go on there, to be honest, as well. I'm not very good at it. But I guess the thing that I do look at is at our at Pilot Episodes tweet-a-thon. So I have a little look at the at that Twitter handle, and we sort of respond through that as and when we get around to it.
Superb. Well, boys, that was most pleasurable. We'll be back, shall we say, 4 weeks' time?
Yeah, I reckon. So just before Christmas.
Just before Christmas.
We've got to do one before Christmas.
Christmas episode. There we go. And we'll post our Christmas crackers to each other, and we'll do notional Christmas bits too.
Yes.
Okay.
God, we're all festive.
Excellent.
Ho, ho, ho.
Right, well.
Down Christmas. There we go.
Just before Christmas then, boys.
Right, well. I've been JB, and from Dunk, Godders, and Parky, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.